From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowen, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, what it's like to be charged by a grizzly. We talk with environmentalist Doug Peacock. For 3 decades, he's been tracking and studying grizzly bears in the mountains of Wyoming and Montana. His work has contributed to their survival. Also, we talk with Charlie Sifford. He's one of the golfers that Tiger Woods acknowledged as a trailblazer. Sifford helped break the color barrier in professional golf. In 1961, he became the first black golfer admitted to the PGA. And film critic John Powers compares and contrasts 2 new films, Paradise Road and Day Trippers. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A judge in Greensboro, North Carolina, has ruled that the Food and Drug Administration can regulate the sale and labeling of tobacco, but it can't restrict tobacco advertising. Paul Brown of member station WFDD in Winston-Salem reports.
Circuit Judge William Osteen released his 65-page decision this morning in response to a challenge of new Food and Drug Administration rules restricting sales and advertising of tobacco. 30 states filed briefs supporting the FDA, but major tobacco companies and several tobacco-producing states challenged the rules. They claimed that the FDA had no authority to regulate tobacco without congressional action. They also said that restrictions on tobacco advertising would violate the constitutional right of free speech. But in today's ruling, the judge said that federal law does allow the FDA to regulate tobacco sales by imposing access restrictions. However, he upheld the tobacco company's right to advertise tobacco. He said that federal law does not give the FDA the power to restrict advertisement and promotion of tobacco products. For National Public Radio, this is Paul Brown in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Air Force authorities say, weather permitting, they will try again to find missing pilot Captain Craig Button. The captain was piloting an A-10 warplane that disappeared 3 weeks ago. Crews found wreckage in a Colorado mountainside this week. Recovery teams had to give up efforts yesterday to reach the wreckage after they bogged down in snow that reached their chests. The crews were later evacuated by helicopter. The Forest Service has closed the area around the crash site on Gold Dust Peak. The service wants to protect civilians from the crash site since the plane carried 4 large bombs. With the reluctant support of Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, President Clinton will now be able to sign documents ratifying a treaty ridding the world of poison gas. The Senate approved the treaty last night by a vote of 74 to 26. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Over the fierce objections of conservatives led by the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Jesse Helms, the treaty was approved by 7 more votes than the 2-thirds majority needed. Helms and others argued that the treaty would do more harm than good by providing Americans with a false sense of security. But he and other opponents convinced the administration to add 28 conditions to the treaty in companion legislation. For example, assurances that the military can still use tear gas when justified, and search warrants will be required when inspectors demand access to U.S. businesses. Those conditions made it possible for Majority Leader Trent Lott and other undecided Republicans to endorse the treaty in the end. Ratification will give the United States a seat on the governing council that sets up inspections and sanctions under the treaty. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 54.5 points at 67.37. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, U.S. stocks have declined this session on concerns about a rise in interest rates and lower earnings. Bloomberg's Paul Lynn reports.
There's continued concern about a jump in interest rates among investors ahead of some important economic data next week. Today we got a bit of a preview in the National Association of Realtors report on home resales, down by 2.8%, but still stronger than expected. The concern about rates has cast a shadow on U.S. stocks this session. At one point, the Dow Industrials were down by 61 points before edging off their lows. Electronic Data Services is one of the day's big decliners. The company's first quarter earnings fell short of expectations. Its shares down by roughly 25%. There's also been some weakness in tobacco shares. A federal judge has ruled that the FDA has the power to regulate tobacco. However, shares of regional telephone companies are on the rise. This after federal regulators approved Bell Atlantic's $23 billion purchase of NYNEX. This is Paul Lynn.
The nation's largest cereal maker says its first quarter profits dropped 22% because of price wars over cereals. Kellogg's income for the first 3 months of the year dropped to $160.6 million. That's down from a little more than $206 million at the same time a year ago. A new report says coffee prices have reached their highest levels in 2 years. The International Coffee Organization says heavy demand has pushed coffee prices up. The average market price today in London was more than $1.50 per pound. Coffee prices have jumped more than 64% this year. Analysts blame a poor forecast for the coffee harvest, along with a trucker strike in Colombia, the world's second leading producer. Again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 54.5 points at 67.37. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other National Public Radio member stations and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. A century ago, more than 100,000 grizzly bears lived in the continental United States. Today, it's estimated that 1% of that number, approximately 1,000 grizzlies, roam the western wilderness of the lower 48 states. My guest, Doug Peacock, has waged a campaign for more than 25 years to save the grizzlies' habitat. After returning from Vietnam in the late 60s, he found solace hiking and camping in remote sections of Yellowstone National Park. He also encountered grizzlies and began to track their movements and record their behavior. Since that time, he's become a leading authority on the grizzly bear and an ardent spokesman for their survival. I spoke with him last summer. Doug Peacock's book, Grizzly Years, written in 1991, chronicles his summers in the late 70s to early 80s when he lived in a place he dubbed the Grizzly Hilton, in bear territory, deep inside Glacier National Park. The story of a scary encounter with a black grizzly is included in his book of essays on bears called Mark of the Bear. As Peacock describes it, he was sitting on a ridge in Glacier, watching a mother and her cub in a meadow, when all of a sudden, the black grizzly appeared.
Well, actually, it was on a knife edge ridge in the wildest part of Glacier National Park, where people never go. There's no trails. It's not a very attractive place. It's buggy and brushy, not very scenic, but it's just full of grizzly bears. And this bear that I call a black grizzly really was my Moby Dick grizzly. He's an incredible bear, but a cantankerous one. And I was on the top of this ridge, looking almost straight down, watching a mother with her yearling cub browse on huckleberries. It was late August, and that's what the bears eat up there. And after about 15 minutes, I was aware of some noise way down in the bottom of this little valley, a little mountain cirque. And you can hear grizzlies a lot of the time before you ever see them in country like that. And all of a sudden, I saw and recognized this black grizzly who, among this group of grizzlies that congregate, you know, loosely. They don't get together for a social occasion, but they get together and put up with one another because of the food. And so it's like a gathering of grizzlies where there may be, 20 or 30 grizzlies in an area of just a few square miles. And they form a sort of dominance hierarchy. And at the top of this hierarchy sat this black grizzly. And it's hard to sex adult grizzlies, but big black ones tend to be males, and there was no question in my mind that the black grizzly was the alpha male of this social congregation. And so I watched these three bears, unaware of each other, browse on huckleberries, moving up the side of a mountain, and it occurred to me that the black grizzly was closing on this mother and her yearling grizzly cub. And I didn't know what was going to happen. At the same time, I'm in the middle of no place. There's a winter storm blowing in, and my tent is on the top of a ridge about a mile away, and all of this is unfolding between me and my tent. Anyway, I looked down, and all of a sudden, I heard a roar and a rush, and I saw the black grizzly racing uphill. Bears, grizzly bears can run very, very fast, up to 41 miles per hour. That's a lot faster than any of our Olympic athletes, you know, by a factor of 15 to 17 miles per hour. And they can run up or downhill at amazing rates. And he ran right up towards this mother and her cub. And the mother naturally raced ahead of this grizzly, ran across the ridge, not more than 100 feet in front of me, the bears unaware of my presence. and continued contouring around the side of a mountain. And the black grizzly was closing on this mother until the black grizzly was just inches behind the yearling club that looked like he was going to get killed. And at the last minute, the mother bear just spun effortlessly on her rear paws and turned around and met this black grizzly. And they roared and they locked jaws and they both rose to a standing position. And, you know, roars to such of the likes of which I've only heard maybe three times in all nature just filled this mountain valley. And this went on for several minutes. And to make a long story short, all of a sudden the black grizzly, when it looked like he was really going to break the neck of this mother and this female grizzly, just turned his head off to the side. And that's a sign that he was done fighting.
Is that a sign that he believes he won?
No, it's just a sign that he's done fighting. And when, grizzlies do this to each other all the time. And once they turn, you know, turn their flank like that, turn their head away, neither grizzly will violate that. It's I don't know what to make of that, but that's just the way it is. And then slowly, the mother moved uphill, rejoined her cub, and the black grizzly stood there on the mountaintop with the sun, you know, disappearing behind the ridge between me and my tent.
And you wanted to get back to your tent.
It was going
to
snow that night. I didn't want to freeze out on the ridge, you know.
But you had this big grizzly bear that was in the way. How did you disguise yourself in order to try to pass by him?
Well, I had to make a decision that I'd had no other option. I had to get back up to my tent. This was sort of a dangerously cold night. I probably wouldn't have died, but I would have been miserable with about 6 inches of wet snow. So I decided I had to go more or less face him down. And I didn't really, I don't know what I do when I'm in those situations. I've done it a number of times, but each time I just sort of let my instincts go. And this time I just remembered I happened to be filming. That's what I was doing in this country. I was not a biologist. I was making the last documentary film of what I thought were the last free-ranging grizzlies in the continental United States. So I had a garbage bag, you know, one in each hand, kind of brown and black, and black and brown grizzlies tend to be males, and I started walking towards this grizzly. And he's only 50 to 100 feet away, and he hadn't seen me yet. And when he looked at me, with me talking, I talk to bears. I don't think it's terribly important what I say. I never remember what I say, but I do talk to them. I never look at them. This is the way they behave around one another. And, you know, this bear saw me and looked straight at me. Grizzlies don't do this to one another because that's a direct confrontation. And his ears went back and the ruff on his back stood up, not unlike a dog. And that means probably you're going to get charged when that happens. And this bear did take one great hop charge, I would call it, slammed his paws down and closed about half the distance to me. And that was a long time ago. But I think this all unfolded in the next 30 or 40 seconds. But I remember talking to the bear looking straight at me from no more than 25 feet away. And then suddenly, without making a sound, the grizzly turned his head smoothly and gracefully off to the side and just disappeared into the brush.
Well, even though you say it doesn't matter what you were saying to the bear, what were you saying to the bear?
Probably something like, "Hey, Black Grizzly, it's just me, good old Arapaho." You know, I used to call myself Arapaho then. And, "Hey, give me another chance. I'll make it up to you later." I remember thinking that that's probably what I said. But it's the tone of voice, like an animal trainer would talk to a horse, that's important.
So Jess, what does that tone sound like?
I think it's conciliatory. It's not loud, but it's loud enough to identify yourself as a human being because I wanted him to know, you know, what I was.
Well, once you got to the camp, the bear came back two more times.
Yeah.
It sounds like to...
No, that was quite a night. I did. I got to this little camp, which is nothing more than a clump of trees on the top of a mountain right at timberline, and it's steep. It's just a little knoll, like a pyramid on three sides. And I built a fire that night, and I never build a fire out there because I don't want to drive the bears away. The bears don't necessarily like fire smoke. But I did that night because I was I got to the top of that ridge and I found myself shaking uncontrollably, which you know hadn't happened to me at that time since Vietnam. And
shaking with fear, I assume.
Well, yeah, I think so. But I started a little fire, and it was dark by then. And no more than an hour later, I could hear the brush crunching. Bears make a lot of noise, especially at night. And this grizzly was coming up the side of the hill to check me out. And I got a few plumes of bear grass burning. Actually, it doesn't burn very well at either. I got it burning with a bunch of sticks. Went off to the side with a little torch 10 feet from the fire, and I can actually see the bear's eyes and talk to it some more, and it went back down the mountain. Well, about 45 minutes later, I heard the bear coming up a different angle of the mountain doing the same thing, and this scene repeated itself until about 2 a.m. when everything got quiet, the bear left, and I fell asleep.
Sounds almost personal.
It was personal. I think, you know, you're never sure of these things. But 2 days later, that same grizzly found my stash of gear tied high in a tree. And this bag contained a, you know, like a tent, a sleeping bag, a dirty T-shirt, some other stuff. The bear didn't touch the tent or anything else, but it literally ate the sleeping bag and a dirty T-shirt, everything that that smelled of me delivering a very personal message, which I took to heart, and I left the mountains the same day.
What was the message? Get the hell out of here?
Get the hell off my mountain.
Okay. We'll talk more with grizzly expert Doug Peacock after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Doug Peacock and his experiences with grizzlies. You've been tracking and writing about and talking about bears for almost three decades. What got you first interested?
My first connection with grizzly bears was because I was a Green Beret medic in Vietnam, and I came back after the Tet Offensive, like many other vets, completely out of sorts. And I wasn't any good around people, didn't want to be around people. The one place that I've always been comfortable all my life is the woods, the wilderness. And so I lived in the American West, and I followed the snow line up towards the Wind Rivers of Wyoming and eventually up into Yellowstone. And that's where I ran into grizzlies. I didn't know anything about grizzlies. I had a malaria attack, and I had to go back into an area that of Yellowstone, which I knew, that had hot springs, and I was going to soak in the hot springs and sort of regain my health, you know, like the old spas. Hmm. And one day I was soaking in a little hot creek in Yellowstone, and it was, you know, it's quite hot. It's like a little bathtub, and the water is probably 108 or 10. You know, it's hot enough so that you got to get in kind of slow. But I looked off to the side, crossed a little meadow, and there's a mother grizzly and two big yearling cubs. And I didn't know anything about mother grizzlies at that time, but except you're supposed to stay away from them, you know, avoid them. They're the most dangerous animal on the continent. So I was soaking in this little hot creek, and it was October. The wind was blowing. The mother grizzly and her cub were probably 150 feet away. They weren't looking at me. They hadn't seen me. But when they weren't looking, I decided I would make a dash for this tree. So I stood up and made a fullbacks rush for this tree. Well, the whirlpool-like effect of the hot water took all the blood away from my brain. I immediately blacked out. I hit the tree, smack, you know, head-on with my forehead, cut a huge gash in my forehead. The blood was running down in my eyes, but I was so terrified I managed to get up the tree anyway. And I got right up to the top of the tree, you know, right up in the uttermost branches, and it turns out it really wasn't much bigger than a Christmas tree. You know, that it was sort of a stupid little tree, no more than 10 feet tall. And so I clung to the upper branches of this tree for about for the next 40 minutes while the grizzly bear and her two cubs grazed in this meadow, coming sometimes as close as 20 or 30 feet away, but never looking at me, pretending they knew, of course, I was up there, but they never looked at me. And meantime, here I am. It's, you know, it's 40 degrees out. The wind is blowing. I'm bleeding. I'm naked. I'm blue with cold and perched in the top of this silly little tree like some species of, you know.
I'm sorry to laugh.
This silly, you know, towhee or sparrow of some kind. Anyway, those bears, they got my attention. That's where it began.
Well, do you feel a kind of kinship with grizzly bears?
I do. And in those days, it was really clear to me, in the safety of retrospect now, 30 years later, almost 30 years later, that those bears really saved my life. You know, they allowed me to you know, regather the elements of my own humanity. And for complicated reasons of gratitude and duty, you know, I felt it was my responsibility to do what I could to improve their plight on Earth. And, you know, curiously, 25, 30 years later, you know, I had sort of decided in those days that, you know, that my battleground, my war would be the war for the American wilderness. And today, some 25 years later, you know, that seems as solid now today as it does, as it did then.
Well, I wonder, too, having been a medic in Vietnam, whether what you learned surviving that war and the jungle conditions of that war, whether you could use some of those skills to live and survive in the American wilderness.
Of course, but I was pretty good at the woods to begin with, and one place I was always comfortable, even in Vietnam, because I was working with irregular troops in mountain areas, mountain yards, in the central highlands of what used to be the southern part or the northern part of South Vietnam. You know, I was always comfortable in the thickest of jungle, even in the jungle night, and I don't think that. I think that was there before Vietnam. But it was the war itself that really convinced me that, you know, that I thought something was going to change in America after the Vietnam War. I really thought that this notion of, you know, the America as a frontier gunslinger, you know, the endless taming of nature, the endless military forays into the Third World, I thought that was going to end then. And I was wrong about that. Things are, you know, as crazy and crazier and as dire today as they were then. And yet my instinct for, you know, the world is on fire, and like a lot of other people, I'd like to put out that fire. And that instinct about saving the wild is still mm-hmm. solid today.
Well, how many grizzlies are there in the United States today?
Well, south of Canada and Alaska, there's less than, it depends, you know, counting grizzlies, the cottage industry, but certainly less than 1,000. Only people that sell hunting licenses would probably say there's more than that. There may be 200 or so in a so-called Yellowstone ecosystem, which means, you know, Yellowstone Park and adjacent forest lands, which is isolated right now from the other area south of Canada that has grizzlies, which is up in Glacier Park and the Bob Marshall. It's called the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem. Bears, there's a few grizzlies in the Selway, in the North Cascades of Washington, possibly a few in the Bitterroot, but this is, you know, less than 1,000 grizzlies altogether. And these are island ecosystems. And, you know, those grizzlies will never survive long term until those populations are linked up with grizzlies that live in Canada and Alaska, where there's estimated to be maybe another 10,000 grizzlies left.
What do grizzlies bring to any habitat, to an ecosystem?
What they bring more than anything else is an attitude to human beings that makes it very clear that we are no longer the top of the food pyramid. I mean, you can put on a Kelty pack and you can hike anywhere, and, you know, in the Adirondacks or Appalachia or the High Sierras or anywhere in Utah or Arizona or New Mexico or Colorado, and you're top dog. But, you know, you put on that same pack and you walk in places in Yellowstone and Glacier where there's grizzlies, and you are unmistakably a second-rate citizen. And it's the human attitude. It's sort of an enforced humility that the bear brings to the ecosystem, and that is the only place on this continent where you can get that attitude. And, you know, not coincidentally, at least in the American West, those little enclaves, those pieces of the original habitat, you know, which we happen to call wilderness today, you know, that was emblematic of what it all was like 500 years ago, you know, very short hunk of time ago, when Lewis and Clark came upstream, you know, 1805 into the American West. They were the first Europeans to hit the Rockies. You know, we had 67 million bison. We had 100,000 grizzlies. We had more wolves. You know, we had endless wild Indians and wild country. And all of that disappeared in a hard breath of historic time. In 100 years, it was all gone. You know, 100. And by 1902, there were 23 wild bison left they couldn't catch in Yellowstone Park.
Do grizzlies live in social networks? I've seen mothers and their cubs, but I've rarely seen bears or grizzlies in large packs or herds.
Grizzlies are known as solitary animals, where bears only get together to mate for about 2 weeks during a year. A productive adult female will probably only breed every 3 to 4 years. So generally you just see mothers with cubs. Sometimes you see brothers and sisters or siblings together in their third or fourth years. But on the other hand, grizzlies are a lot more social. They have social capabilities and tolerances that go way beyond our biology. We haven't watched a lot of that because by the time we got around to studying grizzlies in the early 60s, there weren't any left. But grizzlies do form social aggregations, not because they like each other, but because of food. And probably this took place more than any other place in the state of California. The first grizzly sighted in North America, of record anyway, 1601 in Monterey Bay, Visciano saw a herd of 40 to 60 bears on a whale carcass. Those were grizzlies because black bears didn't live there. And today, grizzlies congregate in Alaska at salmon streams. They used to congregate in Yellowstone at the garbage dumps. And they get together. I wouldn't call it, you know, a social grouping like at salmon streams, but they concentrate in places like in Glacier Park, where they pack themselves into good berry habitat, up in the Alpine in Yellowstone for a couple of weeks to eat just grass. And, you know, the primary reason they put up with each other there is because there's no human beings.
Doug Peacock is a leading authority on grizzly bears. His books include Grizzly Years and Mark of the Bear. He'll talk more about his work in the second half of the show. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the Philadelphia Inquirer, proud sponsor of Four Presidents and the Great American Cleanup, a PBS documentary airing on April 29th in selected cities. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with grizzly expert Douglas Peacock. We talk to golfer Charlie Sifford, the first black player admitted to the PGA. He's played golf for over 40 years. And film critic John Powers reviews Paradise Road and Day Trippers. We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let's continue our interview with Douglas Peacock. He's tracked grizzly bears in the American West for over 25 years, and he's worked to ensure their survival by protecting their habitat. When you're doing your observational work, what are you looking for?
What am I looking for when I go out in a grizzly country? Well, I used to film grizzly bears. I quit filming grizzlies in 1982. So, you know, I can't say that I'm waiting for great shots of grizzlies anymore. I go out to find the bear and to see the bear and watch bears. And, you know, bears are so rare that it's a glorious day if you're lucky enough to see a grizzly. You know, most people go a lifetime, even living in grizzly country, without seeing one. But above all, I like to watch bears at their leisure doing their bearish things. And that means, you know, observing grizzlies where they never know that I'm there. And I like to watch grizzlies, for instance, up at the Grizzly Hilton, where there's enough food and enough security. And again, security for a grizzly means security from human beings and nothing else. And, or, you know, a dense forest or a huge wilderness are equally secure as long as there's no human beings around. And at their leisure, they do amazing things. They're a wonderfully playful animal, which hardly anybody has the pleasure or luxury of seeing anymore, because we don't have many grizzlies. And modern, you know, grizzly bear biology is largely telemetry from satellites and aircraft and stuff like that. Bears are not relaxed enough at salmon streams where people can go to watch them. They don't play there, but they do play in these wild mountain meadows. And that's probably what I love the most, is to see bears really, really unshroud and reveal their very distinct individual personalities, and especially through play.
I've been to Glacier National Park, and I think anyone that goes to that park is given advice about how to hike because you are in grizzly territory. And one of the things we were told was to sing or even to carry a bell around our neck. I guess this way, letting a potential grizzly know that you were in the neighborhood. Does that make sense to you as someone who has tracked and lived with and confronted grizzly bears?
Well, I think it's wise advice that you need not to surprise a grizzly. And there's lots of different ways of doing that. And air horns and bells are one way. But in fact, I think that's bad manners in the wilderness. I mean, we don't have to go. These bears only live in, you know, 1% of their original habitat. And we don't have to go in grizzly bear habitat. And we do. I think the onus is upon us to learn a little bit about the bears. And, you know, I take exception with this endless tinkle of bear bells on trails in the wilderness. I think, you know, if you think you need air horns and bear bells to be safe in grizzly country, maybe you should just go someplace else.
All right,
but there are other ways of being safe in grizzly country. The advice about not surprising a bear is sound.
Okay, so the idea of at least quiet conversation or quiet song fest, would that make sense, and would that be good bear manners?
Well, I'll tell you what. Occasionally, I will make a little bit of noise, but you know, grizzlies are creatures of habit, and you can learn where bears bed, where bears feed, and when and where they travel. And by being alert, you know, you eliminate the need for making noise about 99% of the time. You know, this is not to say that on certain cool mornings on a really brushy trail at a bend in that trail, I might not make a little bit of noise. I've always advised people to learn about bears and stop and don't be cocky. Don't go down that trail. You know, you're not out to have a jog or get exercise. You can get your exercise at the city park, but if you're going to be in grizzly country, travel like an animal. Animals stop. They scent the air. They listen. And bears, you know, bears make a lot of noise. You'll know when a bear is around. And if you need to sing, go ahead and sing softly and not very long and only at very dense, brushy parts of the trails. But never sing country western or crazy country, let me tell you.
And is this from your own experience? Now, what if you are hiking, let's say?
Yeah,
you are in Glacier National Park, you are hiking, and lo and behold, you come upon a grizzly. What do you do next?
Don't run, don't shout, don't look at the bear. This is probably going to happen in the subalpine, and I'm just I happen to know Glacier pretty well, so I'll just let's say you're on a trail up on the Highline Trail, perhaps, and you see a grizzly, say 200 feet down the trail. The important thing is don't do anything fast. I mean, grizzlies have a critical angle, they have a so-called critical territory they may defend. Now, 99% of the time, grizzlies will just run away from human beings. The one dangerous exception are mothers with cubs. And the important thing for human beings is to realize, first of all, that mothers with cubs will do anything to protect their young, but they mean you no harm. And, 80% of all injuries to human beings, maulings, are mother grizzlies protecting their young. And all of those daytime maulings are avoidable. Human beings did something wrong. A lot of national park daytime maulings are people who stumble upon grizzlies bedded. And grizzlies sleep pretty sound on day beds. You can get really close. And so if you're 30 feet away and you surprise a grizzly and you try to run away, you're going to trigger the grizzlies are part predator, and you can trigger that predator instinct. And if it's a mother with her cub, you're definitely going to get charged. And if you keep running, you're going to get attacked. And if you continue to struggle or fight, you're going to get mauled and maybe killed.
Well, of course, the impulse is to run away because you've stumbled upon a grizzly. If you're not supposed to run away, what do you do?
You stand your ground.
Really?
You don't look at the bear. And again, I would probably talk softly. And I've been charged by a number of grizzlies. I've been charged a number of times. And all I can say is so far, so good. But, I talk during that charge. Even with a mother grizzly charging you, she is still deciding in the course of that charge whether she's going to conclude the charge or not. So what you do is important. And above all, you've got to pretend that you're maybe another bear, an equally dominant bear that just doesn't want to fight today, and you mean no harm, and you stand there inoffensively. Don't run, don't shout.
And don't even back away quietly. I mean, you're and I'm just trying to imagine myself trying to do something like this as a grizzly's coming down and coming down on me. You're saying just be there, be a presence, but don't be threatening.
Yeah, and if the bear starts out 100 feet away, look, there are no rules. There are no guarantees, and that's what I love about grizzly country. It's risky. It's a risky proposition having a bear out there. And you should enter, grizzly country with that notion in the back of your mind that you might get, chewed on for no fault of your own. You might even get killed. But nonetheless, the only time that people are likely to get mauled is when they actually stumble upon a bear at very, very close quarters. And maybe a bear on a carcass in the spring. So if you smell rotted flesh, you should stay away from the area. Or, again, a mother grizzly on a daybed. And if you startle a mother grizzly from 30 feet away, she's probably going to be on top of you. Hmm. But listen, a lot of people, by not fighting, by playing dead, have gotten off dirt cheap. So still, what you need to remember is the bear, no grizzly bear means to kill and eat you during the daytime. That's It's not to say that this has not happened in bizarre and unexplainable circumstances at night, but during the daytime, you just you need to remember these simple things.
Have you been in that situation where you actually got
mauled? No, I've never had a bear touch me. I've had a few charged right up to a few feet, and they've all stopped or veered off and run away. So all I can say is so far, so good. This is hardly an idiot-proof strategy, you understand.
I was going to say, do you think you're lucky or smart?
Lucky. And I think the bears in certain cases, like the black grizzly that you first asked me about, in that case, that was totally up to the bear. And he granted me quarter, and I can just be grateful for that. He didn't have to do that. He could have taken my head off just as easily.
There are, according to what you said, some 1,000 grizzly bears left in the lower 48. Do you want to have some kind of program to introduce more grizzlies to the wild the way that's been done with wolves?
No. And the reason is quite simple. There's no there's no place on earth where there's too many grizzlies. And I think that it's, I don't think it's ethical to take an adapted wild bear out of its home and put it someplace else. I mean, for example, grizzlies have a very, very low reproductive rate. Only muskox compare with grizzlies as a land mammal. And grizzlies, cubs spend an average of 2.5 years with their mothers learning a country. And so that's I think not. I tend to look at individuals within a population, like I look at individual human beings, and I would not sacrifice individuals, you know, for to save a population. In a place like Colorado, where there's down in the South San Juan of Colorado, there's maybe a few surviving grizzlies. Now that's a population that does need to be augmented. That, you know, means bears brought in from the outside. And, you know, we haven't really done this yet, but it's possible. There's a lot of cubs bred in zoos that there are no homes for. And they've done a little bit of this work with animals like wolves, but it'd be possible to raise those cubs in a halfway house in wilderness in Colorado away from human beings. Then they'd have a chance of making it. But, you know, I don't feel... what I would like to see, I think we need more grizzlies. I think we need what you know, human beings and Americans in particular need as much as anything else is more wild, untamed country. And this taming of nature we've done since hitting this continent doesn't have to be a one-way road. You know, we can tear up asphalt, we can blow dams, we can turn this around. But what grizzlies need, and I think we need more bears, but what the bears need to increase their own populations is they need human tolerance. They need linkages between grizzlies living in Yellowstone, grizzlies in Glacier. And there's no reason why we can't do that. We have enough biology and technology to bring the mountain goats of Glacier Park under Highway 2 to the Goat Lick on the Flathead, Middle Fork of the Flathead River. And, you know, it's not like there's not going to be problems because, you know, the bottoms of these valleys that connect Yellowstone and Glacier and the Bitterroot and other, you know, grizzly bear ecosystems have a patch board of private lands and Indian lands and federal lands and state lands. We have freeways to cross. But, you know, we could do that. That's something our culture could do if we really wanted to. It's been a failure of imagination so far that you know, we think once the land and habitat is gone, it's gone forever. Well, I don't believe that. That's not the case. We could expand Yellowstone and link up Yellowstone with Glacier to the Bitterroot, to the Selkirks, to Canada. It's not impossible to think about linking grizzlies in Colorado with the grizzlies in Wyoming. It's just something our culture has not done. And again, it's because we fear the unknown and we tend to shoot the bear every time. The bear can put up with us. It's human beings that... have the problem.
Douglas Peacock is an expert on grizzly bears. His books are Grizzly Years and Mark of the Bear. Coming up, black golfer Charlie Sifford. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. When Tiger Woods won the Masters title, becoming the first black player to win a major golf championship, he credited golfers Charlie Sifford and Lee Elder for paving the way. He said, "If it wasn't for them, I might not have had a chance to be here." Charlie Sifford was the first black player admitted into the PGA, the Professional Golfers Association, and the first black man to play on the PGA Tour. To get into the PGA, he had to challenge their whites-only clause that remained in the association's constitution until 1961. During Sifford's career, he won over $1 million in official prize money. He's now in his mid-70s and has been playing in the senior PGA tours. He spoke with Terry Gross back in 1992 when his memoir, Just Let Me Play, was published. He told Terry he was introduced to golf as a caddy at a North Carolina country club, which didn't allow black members. Terry asked him how he learned to play on a whites-only course.
I guess it's just a gift from God, you know, because I used to get out and I'm from a very, very poor family. I had my father and mother, they had six kids, and my father was a laborer. And when I'd get out of school in the afternoon, I would go to the golf course, and I just picked the game up. And when I was 13 years old, I could shoot 70, even par, 71, one over par, and it's something like that. It took a liking to the game.
Would you have to sneak onto the course to play, or would they let you play as a caddy even though the course was officially closed to blacks?
Well, we had a day we called Caddy Day Monday. But sometime I would slip out on the golf course, and that's why the gentleman that owned it, Sutton Alexander, very nice man, and God bless him, he passed, and he used to let me take me out and we play, you know, but after all the members of the golf course got the talking about it, so he asked my mother and father if they would let me go somewhere where I could play golf, and that was to Philadelphia. I had an uncle up there, and I went to Philadelphia in 1939.
Because there was a public course nearby that you could play on.
Right, it's still there.
Now, you say that being the first black on the PGA Tour was one of the most frightening and dangerous things you ever faced. What was dangerous about it?
Well, could you imagine a black man going to North Carolina to play in a PGA-sponsored golf tournament with all white players and one black the first time it ever happened? That's enough to be afraid of. And
were you threatened?
Oh, well, I wasn't going to go. I called my wife, and she's responsible for everything that's happened to me in golf. Because I asked her, what about going to Greensboro? So she said, go ahead on down there. They're not going to bother you. So there I went.
So were you threatened?
Oh, yes. After the first round of the tournament, I shot 68 and led the tournament the first day. And as I went back to these friends' house I lived in, it wasn't in the hotels, and the phone rang, and they asked to speak to Charlie Sifford, so I asked the phone, so this guy said, you a Charlie Sifford? So I said, yeah. So he said, you better not bring your back to the golf course tomorrow. So I told him, I said, well, I tee off at 9:40, and whatever you're going to do, you better get ready to do it because I'll be there. So I went out, teed off, and about 10 or 12 guys started on number one, and it took them to the 14th hole before they could arrest them all.
What were they doing?
Hollering, yelling, calling me names. Didn't hit me, which thank God they didn't. Though I'm sure I wouldn't, you know, may not have been here today as a successful black professional. Well, that's why I said that Jack Robinson, you understand, he's in a different category to me than he was in a ballpark. See, I'm out between those ropes and touchable, you know. Anything could happen, you know. But in the ballpark, he's more safer than I were.
Of course, he had a lot of things thrown at him, didn't he?
He had eight guys with him anyway, you know. And I'm nobody but me and 14 golf clubs.
Well, how did you golf that day? You know, there's such a hush that falls over the crowd when somebody is taking their swing, and here you had all these hostile people out to get you who were hollering and insulting you as you were playing. Did you play well that day?
I think I shot 73 that day.
What was par?
71. I played well behind that because, you know, I had made up my mind I was going to go through with it anyway, you know, as long as someone didn't hit me, you know. So, you know, ain't nothing they can do to turn me around, you know, to break my concentration and break my determination because I had started and I wasn't going to quit.
So when you started on the PGA Tour, even though they had let you in, were there still tournaments that were there still events that you were barred from, or were you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there were?
Oh, sure.
How would that work?
After I got through playing in Greensboro, North Carolina, I got in my car that Sunday night, and I drove all the way to Houston, Texas, where they used to have the Houston Open. And when I got there Wednesday morning to sign up to get in the tournament, I was ran away, told me I couldn't play. And there was a guy that headed the PGA then by the name of Joe Black. So I went to him and asked him what was the thing. I got, what was the reason? I had my approved player's card. Why couldn't I play? So he said, well, there's nothing we could do about it because it's 1962, you know, that Houston wasn't segregated then. You know, everything didn't come down to 64, you know.
How much would you fight when you were turned away, and how much did you feel like you should be, you know, the gentleman and be polite because it might hurt your reputation in the PGA if you became too militant?
Well, I wasn't going to be militant because I knew that's just what they wanted me to be, you know. So I just got in my car and drove on down the highway and got me a towel and just cried and got it off my shoulder and just kept on making me want to play more, you know. And I think when they turned me away in Houston, I think if they had let me play in Houston, I may not never play golf because that really made me mad, you know. And I really wanted to play after they turned me away, after I had the approved player's card in my pocket.
Charlie Sifford was the first black player admitted into the PGA. He spoke with Terry Gross in 1992 when his memoir, Just Let Me Play, was published. This is Fresh Air. This week, two new films open in movie theaters nationwide. Paradise Road is a Hollywood production with big themes, and Day Trippers is a small independent. Film critic John Powers contrasts the two and says the film that may sound important actually isn't.
Back in the 50s, the French director Claude Chabrol wrote a piece attacking movies that deal with big abstract themes, like the loss of innocence or man's inhumanity to man. Get beyond their grandiose intentions, he said, and you realize that these films are nearly always tripe, boring as drama and untrue to life. In contrast, movies that tackle small themes aren't crushed by such bombastic abstractions. They have the space to find the universal in the particular. I thought about this essay when I saw Paradise Road, a World War II yarn that puts a feminine spin on classic POW movies like The Bridge on the River Kwai. The action centers on a Japanese internment camp in Sumatra, whose prisoners are the familiar United Nations of stereotypes, starting with a redoubtable British matron, played by Glenn Close. There's the pushy Yank, the plucky Australian, the pigeon-babbling Chinese, and the exiled German-Jewish doctor, who's played by Frances McDormand like someone auditioning for the Joel Grey role in Cabaret. To keep up their spirits over the years of imprisonment, these women defy the Japanese by forming a choir. They turn their sorrow and yearning into song. The movie was adapted from real events by Bruce Beresford, the Australian filmmaker best known for Driving Miss Daisy. Beresford's a solid professional, but here he's so busy milking his story for uplift that he forgets to give us the vivid characters and conflicts that would draw us into the film. While he doesn't flinch from showing the brutality of the Japanese, there are harrowing scenes of guards beating women. He skims the psychological surface, shying away from the murkier emotions of POW life. At one point, the prisoners are told they'll escape the camp's misery and starvation if they'll simply become comfort women at the Japanese officers' club. Such an offer should pose a real temptation for women who fear dying from the hardship of the camp. But we know instantly that all the main characters will refuse. After all, to have Glenn Close even ponder being a prostitute would be far too disturbing for a movie whose whole aim is to dish up that biggest and tiredest of Hollywood themes, the triumph of the human spirit. In fact, there's far more human spirit on display in the wonderful comedy The Day Trippers. Hope Davis and Stanley Tucci play Eliza and Lewis, a Long Island couple who seem to be the epitome of loving domesticity, until she finds evidence he may be having an affair. Rushing to her family for advice, Eliza soon finds herself in the car heading into Manhattan, along with her long-suffering dad, her bossy mother, her smart-alecky sister Jo, and Jo's boyfriend Carl, who's written an unintentionally hilarious novel about the emptiness of middle-class existence. As this ragtag group drives around the city in search of the wayward husband, they fall into bickering and crosstalk, as when Jo asks Carl, who's played by Liv Schreiber, to talk about his novel.
Carl, tell Mom and Dad about your novel. Carl wrote a novel, everyone. It's great. It's just far out. It's brilliant.
I don't think your parents want to hear my novel.
Mom and Dad, do you want to hear about Carl's novel?
Oh, yeah, sure, Carl.
Well, Rita, it's an allegory about spiritual survival in the contemporary world. The main character is this freak of nature. He's this man who doesn't have a normal head. He was born with a dog's head.
A dog's head?
Yeah, you know, sort of a fantastical story.
It's like a fable.
Yeah, like Master and Margarita or...
Animal Farm.
Animal, yeah, exactly. Very Kafka-esque.
Carl, I'm not an educated woman.
It's Dr. Seuss for adults, Mom.
Oh. Oh, yeah.
So, everyone else in the book is normal except for the man with the dog's head, who really only wants...
What kind of dog?
Dad, it's not important.
No. It is important. Actually, that's very important. It's a German short-haired pointer. You see, it's actually especially important that it's a pointer because that's a crucial metaphor. Because in the book, he's sort of a visionary, you know? You know, pointing the way to salvation.
Joe loves dogs.
The Day Trippers was written and directed by Greg Mottola, one of the increasingly rare filmmakers whose humor is tinged with tenderness, not derision. Far from thinking that middle-class life is empty, Mottola offers his own roadmap of Cheever and Updike territory. He captures the confused yearning that percolates beneath ordinary suburban silliness. With the exception of the mother, who's overplayed by Anne Meara, the characters all reveal secret emotional shadings. Just as Joe's acid tongue masks her inner uncertainty, so Carl is not the pretentious buffoon his novel makes him appear. He's redeemed by being genuinely kind. By the time Eliza finally catches up with her husband in unexpectedly wrenching circumstances, we realize that the movie's small theme has actually been given a very big treatment. What looked at first like a sunny little comedy is actually a sly portrait of loneliness, family dysfunction, and middle-class naivete.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Today's show was directed by Alan Tu, and today we say thank you, good luck, and a job well done to our departing intern, Regina O'Toole. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publishers of Alice Walker's new book, Anything We Love Can Be Saved, A Writer's Activism. This is NPR, National Public Radio.